What makes a city holy? Why were Hebron, Tiberias, Safed, and Jerusalem holy cities, while according to our tradition, Haifa, Jaffa, Caesarea, and Nablus were not? Holiness, of course, is in the eyes of the beholder. The best way, I think, to make this point is to tell you a story that I heard about 25 years ago. A man named Zev Vilna was one of those superb guides which Israel had. He won the Israel Prize for his works recording Israel's legends and history, and he wrote an encyclopedia on the land of Israel. Once as a young guide, in a particularly expansive mood, he improvised this legend about a huge rock, which supposedly was seven feet high on a hilltop in the mountains of Judea. When the Romans besieged Jerusalem in the year 70, the leaders of the besieged city sent messengers to every Jew in the surrounding towns and villages, asking each to bring a large stone to strengthen the fortifications of the city and of the temple. In those days, there lived in a village a mighty man descended from Samson. The strength of his ancestors flowed in his veins. Learning that Jerusalem needed help, his spirit rose up in him. He tore a massive boulder out of the side of the mountain, heaved it on his shoulders, and began to walk towards the holy city. He was still on the mountain path when he saw a thick pillar of smoke rising from the hills in the east. He realized that he had come too late. The city had been taken, and the temple had been destroyed. He stumbled, and he fell in tears. His strength ebbed away. The mighty stone pressed him down and crushed him to death under its weight. Since then and until this day, that massive rock has been known as the Rock of Destruction, in memory of his death and the destruction of the temple. And Zev Vilna was pleased with this story and included it in the next edition of a volume which he wrote called The Legends of Palestine. And it turned out that Vilna had created a modern legend. Many years later, taking a group of visitors on a tour of Judean historic places, he decided to take them to the Rock of Destruction. As they approached, a Yemenite Jew who had been standing alongside the rock came up to Vilna and courteously suggested that the veteran guide cover his head. "This is a holy spot," the Yemenite said, and fervently kissed the stone. "How could I tell him," Vilna asked, "that if he venerated this story, it was rather me that he kissed rather than the stone?" Another epilogue to Vilna's story. Israel's minister of religion, eager to preserve the identity of holy places that might be lost and forgotten, held one day a ceremony dedicating the Rock of Destruction and erecting beside it a plaque marking it as an official holy shrine. Vilna, incidentally, was not invited to the ceremony. Now, holiness is our sense of a special power. In the Western tradition, we would call it the presence of the power of God, emanating from a particular object, or place, or act, or even human being. The Latin word sanctus is a direct translation of the Hebrew kadosh, holy. A place where worship is held is called a sanctuary, a holy place. Now, our response to holiness may be spontaneous. When Isaiah was in the temple in Jerusalem, he was overcome with a sense of the presence of God. And he blurted out the famous phrase, "Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh, Adonai Tzvaot, Melo Chol Ha'aretz Kavodo," "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, the whole earth is full of his glory." The temple in Jerusalem was called the Beit HaMikdash, the holy house. An entire section of Talmud which deals with the inscriptions, instruments, and vessels, rituals, and sacrifices used in the temple. And it's called Kadashim. The supreme act of loyalty against Jew can show his faith is called Kiddush Hashem, martyrdom. The word Kadosh, holy, comes from an old Akkadian root, kadashi, which means to be bright or to shine. Almost every emotion has a physical quality associated with it in our minds. For after all, we are creatures of our senses. The sense of luminescence, of charisma, is that which we associate with holiness. When Moses comes down from the mountain after he's been with God receiving the commandments, his face is alight with a sense of the holy. He has been in the presence of God. Artists in nearly every culture picture their saints or holy men with a nimbus or halo around them to identify their holiness and their power. And it is true. One who is holy has power, a power which can be both useful to mankind and a danger. When Moses comes down from the mountain, he can no longer live within the encampment, but must, as a holy man, live outside the camp in a tent set apart. Now that apartness is generally true by the way of shamans and holy days, holy men, African and Indian tribes. A recognition in moments of need, they can plead with the elements or with God more successfully than we can. But they must be kept at a distance, they and the fearful power that they represent. Men have always felt that any failure to relate properly to what is holy can be a source of danger. Just as those who today operate nuclear power plants must be precise and careful with the procedures they use, so the priests who entered the Holy of Holies in the Temple of Jerusalem did so with fear and trepidation. Indeed, in Second Temple days, only the high priest was allowed once a year to enter the Devir, the Holy of Holies, and only after several nights of instruction from other priests as to the exact steps he should take, exact genuflections he should make, the exact confessions he should speak. For if he made a single mistake while in the Holy of Holies, it might be a fatal mistake for him and for his community. Our biblical myth describes a sense of power we instinctively ascribe to holy things. During the war between the Philistines and the Israelites, the Philistines captured the Holy Ark and took it to their capital. There the ark caused such confusion that the Philistines sent an emissary to the Hebrews demanding that the ark be taken back. They couldn't handle its wild, destructive energy. Holiness is not necessarily to man's benefit. It does not necessarily mean that because we are in the presence of what seems holy, we will be blessed by that presence. A false prophet exudes the same sense of awe and reverence as a true prophet. Holiness, then, is neither beneficial nor harmful, neither good nor bad. Holiness evokes a natural and instinctive response. Remember the secular Jews who went to Jerusalem right after the 67 war, when for the first time it was possible to visit the Western Wall, and how they came back one by one to tell us that visiting the Wall had been one of the most moving and powerful spiritual experiences of their lives. What could it possibly mean to a secular Jew? It was the first time that many had sensed something of the holy history of Jerusalem and of the temple. It was a sign of the renewal of Jewish life in our times. Whatever it was, the Wall gave off vibrations powerful enough to move people like us, who are not actively caught up in the holiness of rocks or graveyards or amulets. Because holiness is such a powerful emotion, and such a basic one, wise religious leaders have always tried to fill the term with the experience with something more than pure awe. The Bible set the pattern. There is that wonderful section of Leviticus which we read on Yom Kippur. Holy shall ye be, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. And it tells us in what holiness is meant to consist. Be fair in rendering judgment, remove the stumbling block from in front of the blind, leave the gleanings of the field for the poor, use just weights and just measures, love your neighbor as yourself. And Jerusalem begins its history as a rather undistinguished town during the second millennium BCE, a Canaanite town ruled by priest kings who spoke one of the Canaanite tongues. In Abraham's time, it was called Shalem, which does not mean despite the pious homilies you've heard over the years, that it is the same as Shalom, peace. Jerusalem means simply the city of Shalamu. Shalamu was one of the great moon gods of the Canaanites. Jerusalem seems to have escaped conquest by the Israelites longer than any other major town in the Judean hills. Not until the year 993 BCE, 250 years after the beginning of the conquest, was David finally able to conquer Jerusalem. And then he moved his capital a few miles north from Hebron to Jerusalem, and he made it his city. Jerusalem was then a very small town, like all Canaanite towns. It had a high place, the threshing floor of Araunah, which David purchased from its owner. Some years later, Solomon built on this high place a royal shrine. It became one of the shrines the Israelites served during the 10th, 9th, and 8th centuries BCE, but it was not the only shrine. The great shrines then were the Shiloh, Beth-El, and Samaria. Jerusalem owes its very special position to the Davidic dynasty, which established it as the nation's capital and maintained it throughout its history. Jerusalem became holy because a miracle took place there in the 8th century BCE. The Assyrian Empire arose in what is now Iraq. Its capital was Nineveh, who was the mightiest empire of the age. Assyria subdued all lands east of it and then moved westward towards Syria and across Syria and Lebanon to the Mediterranean. Their ultimate aim was to move south and to conquer Egypt. For about 20 years, the Assyrians systematically destroyed one by one the small communities of Syria and Lebanon, including the largest of the Hebrew kingdoms, the Northern Kingdom of Israel. Samaria, the capital of the Northern Kingdom, was captured in 722 BCE. Although Jerusalem was nothing more than a small town city-state, it somehow survived. Another 15 years passed. The Assyrians decided that before they could move directly against Egypt, they had to take out the few small, out-of-the-way city-states that lay behind what would be their front lines. In the year 701, the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, laid siege to Jerusalem, the city and its king. And Hezekiah had no chance, but a strange thing happened then. For the preceding years, the prophet Isaiah had brought God's judgment against Jerusalem for the sins of the community. He had told the people that they had violated the covenant, that deserved attack and punishment would come. Then surprisingly, Isaiah began to speak consoling words in the name of God. I, God, will be a shield about the city to deliver it. No sooner had Isaiah spoken these words than Sennacherib lifted the siege of Jerusalem and returned to the east. The miracle. The Bible explains this miracle by saying that the angel of God had appeared at night in the Assyrian camp and had destroyed 185,000 men. Archaeologists have found one of the great stelae testifying to Sennacherib's victories, which says simply that King Hezekiah paid a great ransom tribute in order to lift the siege. Modern historians tend to believe that a message summoned Sennacherib back to his capital, something to do with the rise of the power of the Babylonians, a much more powerful danger than anything the Judeans represented. Whatever the explanation, Jerusalem was spared. God had protected his city. He had protected his temple, and Jerusalem became what it was to remain forever, a holy place. Since at least 721 BCE, the temple has been the only major surviving Judean shrine. The temple complex of buildings and its holy objects became the main preoccupation of the priest theocrats who ruled in Israel during the Babylonian and Persian period. Nearly a century after the Assyrian miracle, the Babylonians in their turn were ready to move west toward the Mediterranean to try to conquer Egypt. They too besieged Jerusalem. There was then a new crop of prophets in Jerusalem. Jeremiah had been saying much the same things Isaiah had a century before. This tragedy has come upon you because you have been unjust and unrighteousness, and you deserve your fate. What Jeremiah did not say was that God has lifted your fate. He has forgiven. Rather, he said again and again, the city would be destroyed. In one of his most powerful sermons, Jeremiah attacks directly the illusion that there are places so holy that they cannot be harmed. He said, "Do not put your trust in illusions and say, 'The temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord, the temple of the Lord are these buildings. They're inviolate.' Not so. They too will be destroyed." And they were. Not once in the Bible is holiness defined by what most people think is holy behavior. Living a monastic life, maintaining long vigils, withdrawing from the world, adopting celibacy and self-flagellation. The kind of holiness that to a large degree made for the authority of the Christian saints. Not once does Judaism describe holiness in those terms. Judaism says that holiness has to do with righteous living and all that we associate with the word righteousness. Yet mankind and Jews have never for a moment abandoned all illusion, the illusion that there are holy objects, holy things we can wear around our necks to protect us from danger, holy things we can put on the dashboard of our cars to protect us from accidents, magical acts we can perform that will protect us from evil. Even the illusion that there are holy people. These illusions only prove that human beings are fallible and mortal and anxious, and that there are times when miracles seem to occur. And every one of us would like every chance for one to happen to us. When the temple in Jerusalem was rebuilt after the exile, people brought their sacrifices and their prayers, their needs and fears and hopes. Holy acts were performed there, to which the people ascribed holy significance. Sometimes their needs and hopes were answered. For ultimately, if you are willing to suspend disbelief, things will happen that would not happen otherwise. Faith healing is a case in point. The major holiness of Jerusalem is its role in the drama of the coming of the Messiah. In Jerusalem, they will point out to you a church of the remission. Beneath it, they will tell you, lies the tomb of King David. The Talmud already readily admits that the location of David's tomb is not known, but it has always been believed to be in Jerusalem, and from the 12th century to be in this place. What's called the Tomb of David is nothing more or less than an old cave. In the 12th century, workers building the church above this place, the place where the Last Supper is said to have taken place, stumbled on this cave. They held it to be holy because of the belief that in the Messianic age, David's tomb would be unsealed, and David would emerge and be again king over Israel. So the search for David's tomb was something more than an idle search. A wonderful legend captures some of the sense of holiness that envelops this tomb. In the Middle Ages, according to this legend, two yeshiva students in Europe spent all their days and nights studying and praying to learn the secret date of the coming of the Messiah, the date that would end Israel's suffering. Elijah finally took pity on them and told them, "You can be harbingers of the Messiah. But to be so, you must do exactly as I tell you. Take the sealed cruse of oil with you and go to Jerusalem. Go to a certain mountain and to a certain rock. Before that rock, repeat this magic formula." And he gave them the formula. "The rock will open. Inside of the rock, you will see King David's golden throne and his golden harp. But you must pass these wonders by and go down into the cave. And there you will see a bier. And you will see King David sleeping, the sleep of death, on top of the bier. His hands are folded. When you come before the bier, you must recite exactly another magic formula." He gave them the second formula. "King David will begin to move. His hands will unfold. Then you must take this cruse of oil and pour it into his right hand. He will come to life. Israel's travails will be over." two young men took, took the cruse of oil and began the long journey to Jerusalem. They found the rock, with fear and trepidation, recited the formula. The rock opened, and there before their eyes were the golden throne of David and his golden harp. The two students concentrated on their mission, and they went down into the cave, and there was the bier, and there was David in his sleep. They then recited the second magic formula exactly as Elijah had given it, but they were full of fear and trepidation. David began to stir, to open his hands. Overwhelmed, the men took the cruse of oil and poured it, but on his left hand, not on his right hand. And David's hands folded up, and he went back to sleep. And we are still awaiting the coming of the Messiah. This city, Jerusalem, where the Messiah will first appear, is a city where resurrection will begin. On the east side of the town is the Mount of Olives, which is, as you know, principally a giant graveyard. My grandparents are buried there, by the way. Why is the graveyard on the Mount of Olives? Because the mount is the exact place where resurrection will begin. Why? Because the Bible so stipulates. In the last great apocalyptic vision of the prophet Zechariah, who wrote, "On that day, the day of judgment, I will set his feet on the Mount of Olives near Jerusalem on the east. The Mount of Olives shall split from east to west. Living waters shall come forth from Jerusalem. The Lord shall be king in all the earth." Resurrection will take place here. The Mount of Olives acquired in time its own holiness. Throughout the Middle Ages, small bags of earth taken from the Mount of Olives were carried by the Shlichim throughout the diaspora. The Shlichim were those men who went out from Jerusalem to raise money for those Jews who lived a life of prayer and petition for the coming of the Messiah. So every village in Europe, and I suppose even here in America, pious Jews were buried with little bags of earth gathered from the Mount of Olives. Somehow being buried with that dust reassured them that they too would rest in the earth in the Mount of Olives at the time of the resurrection, that they would be among the first to be resurrected. I can still remember one of the older members of the temple who was born in the Ukraine, who told me that he'd been taken as a child to some hillside caves outside a little town. And there his father told him, "These are the caves through which the bodies of Jews would begin to roll towards Jerusalem when the Messiah would come and the time of resurrection would be at hand." So resurrection and immortality have also been part of the holiness associated with Jerusalem. Arabs share the sense of the city's holiness with us. They call it Al-Quds, the holy city, and make sure that their cemetery on the Mount of Olives is closer to the Eastern Gate, the Golden Gate, than the cemetery of the Jews. Today, the city's holiness seems closely associated with the Western Wall. Despite all you've heard, the custom of coming to pray at the Western Wall is relatively recent. It was not mentioned in the literature before the 16th century, when the Turks conquered Jerusalem. The city and the Jewish community fought over the rights of Jews to come to the wall. During most of Turkish times, Jews were allowed very limited access, and then only through a narrow alleyway. And this practice lasted well into the 20th century. At least a dozen international commissions were formed during the first 30 years of the century to try to deal with the issue of the Jews and their access to the Western Wall. Diplomats from neutral countries, Sweden, France, the United States, met solemnly for days on end, trying to decide whether a Jew could or could not bring a sacred Torah to the wall on Yom Kippur, whether Jews were allowed to touch the wall, whether they might, by some ancient rite, come into their courtyard in front of the wall. Somehow the wall has become a symbol of the restoration of Jerusalem, a symbol that says that no modern Rome can destroy Israel. Legends have grown up that Roman conquerors in the year 70 had not been able to pull down this section of the wall when they pulled down the rest of the temple. The wall resisted on its own and therefore was left standing. It became proof that God stood by his city and protected his temple, even in defeat, and that he would and could, in time, rebuild his shrine. Actually, the Romans left the Western Wall for a very practical reason. It was a retaining wall, built by Herod in order to enlarge the plaza at the top of the Temple Mount. The wall itself had nothing to do with the buildings or the fabric of the temple. The Romans wanted to keep the plaza, and to do so, they had to keep the wall that held up the hillside. Whatever the real reason that the wall survived, medieval legend had it that God have protected this wall. Indeed, that he waited behind the wall to hear your prayers. Prayers recited there would be heard, and they would be answered. The custom grew of writing little kvittel, prayer petitions, and sticking them in the crevices of the wall itself. This pious legend of God waiting behind the wall is based on a lovely text from the Song of Songs, which bespeaks the certainty that God hears your prayers. God waits behind the wall for Israel's repentance, for the time when he could send the Messiah. Wait, my beloved, there he comes, tripping over the mountains, bounding over the hills. There he stands behind the wall, my beloved spoke, he said, my fair one, come away. For though the winter is past, the rains are over and gone, blossoms are again seen in the land. Jerusalem is one of the four ancient cities whose holiness remains integral to Jewish life today. More than any other factor, it is the wall that will prevent the city of Jerusalem from ever being redivided. The wall speaks of the past. More importantly, it speaks of the present and of the future. It speaks of all the immemorial hopes of the Jewish nation. It speaks to the secular Jew in one way, to the religious Jew in another. To all Jews, it bears a comforting message. Now, there is holiness to the east of Jerusalem, and holiness to the west of Jerusalem, and holiness above Jerusalem. Jerusalem has a heavenly counterpart. There is a city we know, which is below, and a city which we do not know, a city above, a city which is in the future, is in the future, a city which is a very model of what a great city must be. Whenever Jerusalem has been in Jewish hands, Jews have tried to establish rules for the city, which would in fact make it a model city. The Talmud contains many of the rules. Many others go back as far as the Dead Sea Scrolls. Their purpose is to distinguish Jerusalem from all other ancient cities. There must be no dung heaps in Jerusalem. Ancient cities had great dung heaps. Wherever they were, their vermin and insects multiplied. Garbage was collected in Jerusalem every day. There were to be no kilns in Jerusalem, and no furnaces. No smoke would pollute the air. A corpse was not allowed to remain in Jerusalem overnight. The streets of Jerusalem are not to have balconies built over them. The citizens could not, as they did in other ancient cities, simply reach out and pitch their dirty water and garbage into the center of the streets. There were to be no orchards or gardens or chicken coops in Jerusalem. At first glance, a strange ruling. Remember that gardens and orchards require fertilizer, dung, and that chickens are noisy. Jerusalem should be, in short, the very model of gracious life on earth, the very model for our ecological movement today. Jerusalem to this day remains a remarkably clean city. Teddy Kollek's beautification plans are in an old and honorable tradition. When you went to Jerusalem, you went up. You made Aliyah. You sang one of the pilgrim songs of ascent. Jerusalem is on the top of the mountain, the highest place on earth, closest to heaven, the place, therefore, where prayers are most likely to be heard. And none of that is true, but it is all part of the belief in the holiness of the city. The holiness of Jerusalem to the major Western face makes political solutions hard to come by. What should Jews and Christians and Muslims give up? What can they give up? It is to the Jews, the city of God. It is to the Muslims, Al-Quds, the holy place. It is to Christians, the place where Jesus walked and died, the place of the Holy Sepulcher. What this means for the future of the Middle East is hard to tell. It certainly means that Jerusalem must remain undivided. Since the rise of Christianity and then of Islam, whenever either Christians or Muslims have held the power, to do so, they locked out Jews and each other from everything sacred to them. That is not control the Jews were ever likely to give back to others, nor are Jews likely to relax Jewish sovereignty. When Jews control Jerusalem, non-Jews are welcome there. When Christians and Muslims controlled Jerusalem, life was made very, very difficult for Jews. Since 1967, the shrines of Muslims and Christians have been protected, inviolate, and open. Jews are the only people who have protected the faith of those who believe other than we do, to recognize that holiness can be shared, even though it operates in different ways among different flocks. This is one of the considerations which a Jew knows deep in his heart, and that the world has yet to learn. Amen.